This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up in our left-hand margin. I'm Dan Daniels. Regular listeners of our podcasts or our live streaming feed might know Rick Britton. He's an historian and cartographer and frequent guest on WINA's Charlottesville's Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Rick also organizes a Civil War lecture and day trip series in conjunction with the Charlottesville Senior Center. On September 20th, 2008, one of the speakers, Bill Bergen, appeared at the Senior Center to talk about the June 1864 through March 1865 siege of Petersburg, Virginia. This fascinating 9-month-long siege operation, which pitted Robert E. Lee's 60,000-man army of Northern Virginia against U.S. Grant's force of 120,000, featured numerous large-scale actions, including the famous Battle of the Crater. Rick Britton introduced today's speaker.
Bill Bergen has been a student of the Civil War since learning about Abraham Lincoln in first grade in Dayton, Ohio. Such was his obsession, I can totally understand obsessing about the Civil War, that his fourth grade teacher told Bill's parents that he should be held back a year because all he did was talk about events that took place 100 years ago. He has led numerous battlefield tours over the past 30 years, has lectured widely on the Civil War, and is a regular instructor at the University of Virginia's annual Civil War Conference, where he is the resident expert on the Union Army of the Potomac. Most of the other speakers, of course, talk about Confederate officers and the Confederate Army. In addition to book reviews, Bill is the author of The Other Hero of Cedar Creek, The Not Specially Ambitious Horatio G. Wright, a lengthy biographical essay. He is now engaged in a long-term study of the relationship of politics to generalship in the Army of the Potomac. Though his advanced degree is in public administration, Bill is an assistant dean at the University of Virginia School of Law. And as far as he knows, he's the only graduate of Vassar College to become a Civil War military historian. Before working for the law school, he held a variety of jobs, the most recent of which was as the U.S. Postal Service's senior legislative analyst. Bill gave 2 years of service to his country. As a conscientious objector, he performed alternative service with social service organizations in New York and Virginia. He's married to Beth Meyer, an associate professor of landscape architecture at the University of Virginia's School of Architecture. His topic tonight, of course, is Horatio Wright and the Breakthrough on April 2nd. And the title of the talk is Bloody Business. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to my friend, Bill Bergen.
Rick's one of those very smart people who always asks you so far in advance to do one of these talks, you can't possibly say no, because, of course, well, it's all that far in the future, and you know, things will always clear up in terms of your personal life, and so I told him that I could talk about Horatio Wright and the Breakthrough and about Pamplin Park, and I do endorse the idea of going to Pamplin Park. There we go. That should be good, Rick. Thanks. But as I began looking at Horatio Wright, I thought, well, you know, I am the world's living expert on Horatio Wright, and I could really bore you. And then I thought, you know, well, if I talked about that, I should talk about this. And if I talked about that, well, then I should talk about this. And if I talked about that, well, suffice to say that you're going to hear 10 months of the siege of Petersburg tonight, and kind of a gallop through those events. And it's a kind of daunting task to do that. But I hope we get some good discussion at the end. A lesser general might have decided it was time to withdraw, to disengage from the enemy, and refit while waiting for reinforcements. Certainly the unprecedented casualties suffered over the past month would justify the move. And the precedent in this most important of the Union armies was on the side of such caution. Withdrawals were the pattern for the Army of the Potomac before the spring of 1864. But now, in early June, as Lieutenant General Ulysses S. Grant, still less than 90 days into his post as General-in-Chief, pondered the situation, he saw not problems, but opportunities. As he puffed on his ever-present cigar, a plan began to form. Grant would make his movement with an army worn down by a month of constant fighting. Many of the best units were all but wrecked for offensive action, and what reinforcement he had received were nearly all completely inexperienced. In a month's time, he had lost 54,000 men, a number nearly equal to the size of the opponent's army at the start of the campaign. A few miles away, Confederate General Robert E. Lee weighed his dwindling options. He had not given Grant what Grant had sought, a stand-up fight in open fields, and his army had inflicted nearly twice the number of casualties that it had absorbed. But neither had Lee been able to damage his opponent so decisively that he could disengage and slip once more into the Piedmont and head north. Moreover, his own army was sadly depleted from what had been a year before, in the hopeful interlude between victory at Chancellorsville and defeat at Gettysburg. Like Grant, his casualties totaled nearly half his army. What Lee feared most was that Grant would get across the James and attack the vital city of Petersburg. If he gets there, he told a subordinate that same week, the army would be besieged, and then it would be only a matter of time. The first thing that you need to know about the siege of Petersburg is that it was not a siege. A siege is a military blockade of a city or a fortress with the intent of conquering by attrition and or assault. While the extended trench warfare took on the aspects of a siege, U.S. Army forces were never able to block all avenues of escape. The second thing you need to know is that the series of battles that made up the siege of Petersburg ranged far afield from the ground east and west of that city. The fortified lines of both sides ranged from northeast of Richmond to the James, across the James to the peninsula formed by the James and Appomattox rivers, and finally to the southern side of the Appomattox. Moreover, raids launched from Petersburg lines covered huge swaths of south side Virginia. The third thing you need to know about the Petersburg campaign is that the common comparison of Lee versus Grant is misleading. The army that Grant took across the James was one that he had virtually no role in forming, hardly knew its units and its commanders, and did not know the territory over which the army fought. Lee, in contrast, had commanded his army for more than 2 years, had chosen his subordinates, and was familiar with all their commands and what they were capable of doing. What's more, he knew intimately, the landscape and could readily secure spies and guides for his army. The story of the siege, in some sense, is the story of Grant slowly gaining control of his army and forming it into the formidable force that finally broke through the Petersburg lines and drove Lee to Appomattox. The fourth point is by the time the armies reached Petersburg, the stakes could hardly be higher. The Confederacy's best hope for independence lay not on the battlefield directly, but in the defeat of U.S. President Abraham Lincoln by a peace-oriented Democrat. To accomplish this, the Confederate armies needed at a minimum to hold on to the territory it had, to avoid, in other words, losing. The challenge to the United States was to be victorious enough to ensure that Lincoln was reelected. Fifth, Petersburg was important because it was the road and railroad hub for Richmond. Supplies and troops headed to Richmond from the south had to pass through Petersburg, where they were concentrated on a single railroad and a single road to the Confederate capital, 25 miles to the north. Capture Petersburg, and you capture Richmond. Finally, the move to Petersburg was one of several simultaneous thrusts made at the Confederacy that spring. Grant, on taking overall command of U.S. armies, devised a way to keep the pressure on at many points as possible. William T. Sherman, taking Grant's place as commander of the U.S. Western forces, was to confront the Confederate principal army in the West and make for Atlanta. Nathaniel Banks was supposed to leave Louisiana to move against Mobile. That part of the plan went awry from the first, as Banks was already bogged down in a Red River campaign that had much more to do with politics than with strategic necessity. A small army under Benjamin Butler was to move up the James towards Richmond, while Grant accompanied George G. Meade's Army of the Potomac as it headed south. Grant planned other diversions in Virginia besides Butler's expedition up the James. Two small forces were to advance out of West Virginia and attack railroads and other vital points in southwest Virginia. A small army under Franz Sigel was to move south up the Shenandoah to pin down the Confederate forces there. The result, however, was failure on all Virginia fronts save Meade's. Grant's plan came to naught because of the timidity of some commanders and the outright incompetence of others. Sigel met decisive feat at New Market. The two smaller forces in the southwest turned back without accomplishing much of anything. And the timid Butler allowed himself to be bottled up and stopped on the peninsula by an inferior force. Small wonder, then, that Grant needed a new plan. The story of the march of the Army of the Potomac from the Cold Harbor lines, located a few miles north of the Richmond Airport, to approach Petersburg from the east is one of complex planning and successful execution. But the story was all too familiar. A brilliantly executed end run ended up in colliding with the cautious and bungling nature of what Bruce Canton, this great Civil War chronicler, called this most unlucky of armies. And Canton went on to say this: "The Army of the Potomac has been led to disaster many times, and there is a rather horrible fascination about tracing in each case it reached, that it reached its destination. We will be horribly fascinated tonight." With clock-like precision, Grant's army quietly disengaged from the lines at Cold Harbor and wound their way via different routes to the James. Their engineers had produced a marvel, a 2,500-foot pontoon bridge that rose and fell with the tide and could withstand the strong James River current. There's a photograph of the bridge. While some troops crossed the bridge, others embarked on a flotilla of boats. Among the latter was the fabled Second Corps commanded by the Army's best corps commander, Major General Winfield Scott Hancock. But Hancock's best days were behind him. The serious wound that he had suffered at Gettysburg had never healed, and he frequently had to take to an ambulance in order to keep up with his troops. Moreover, his proud corps, once known as the best assaulting force in the Army, had suffered so many losses during the Overland campaign that it was scarcely recognizable. The first assaults on Petersburg were directed by a cautious engineer, William Baldy Smith. There are so many Smiths in the Army, everyone. Hey, there's Scott. There we go. There's Baldy Smith on the left. There were so many Smiths in the Army that every Smith had to have a nickname. And you could see why maybe Baldy would fit William Fryer Smith. The first assaults on Petersburg were directed by this cautious engineer. In the early afternoon of June 15th, less than 2 weeks after he had suffered horrendous casualties in front of the Cold Harbor trenches, Smith's troops approached the formidable Dimmock Line on the eastern approaches to Petersburg. The Dimmock Line, named after the engineer who had laid out that line of trenches, was formidable in appearance and would have been nearly impregnable had it been defended with a sufficient number of soldiers. But as Smith's 15,000 men approached, only 2,200 Confederates stood between them and seizing the city. They were commanded by the sometimes brilliant, but nearly always erratic, Pierre Toutant Beauregard. Smith asked to see some of the outer fortifications and decided to wait for Hancock's Second Corps that was moving to reinforce him. Hancock, meanwhile, had received no orders to attack and was moving slowly in the intense June heat, and he did not arrive on the scene until after dark. The delay gave Beauregard just enough time to scrape together another line that barely held off a series of uncoordinated attacks the next day. Federal forces did somewhat better the next day, and by the nightfall of the 17th, it was clear that the 18th would be the day of decision for Petersburg. During his desperate defense of Petersburg, Beauregard sent several messages to Lee, who was still with the bulk of his troops north of the James, that he was under attack by superior forces. Beauregard had a reputation for exaggerating danger, and Lee did not initially believe him. Convinced at last that the main U.S. effort was in front of Petersburg, Lee arrived before noon on the 18th at the head of substantial reinforcements. Another day of brilliant defensive moves threw off the timing of federal assaults, and again the Confederate lines held. Nightfall found the Union Army in a familiar position. Opportunities had been wasted, and 10,000 men had been lost over the four-day series of attacks. Though they had captured some key ground and inflicted nearly 4,000 casualties, the stage was set for what would become a siege. While both armies regrouped, the always efficient U.S. Quartermaster Department set up a massive supply base at City Point, a small town at the confluence of the James and Appomattox River, some 8 miles behind Union lines. Over the next few weeks, Grant conducted a series of moves south and west of the existing lines in an attempt to extend his position and to damage, if not break altogether, some of the roads and railroads that fed into Petersburg. And there you can see, if you look on the left-hand side, you see Ide Railroad. That's the South Side Railroad, a very important line that goes into Petersburg. There is also one that comes up from the south, which I believe is the Weldon Railroad. And the Plank Road there was also very important. So the idea of Grant had was to swing down to your left, below Petersburg, and cut those. And that would be the dynamic for the entire campaign. These operations of Grant were only partly successful, and the always aggressive Lee launched a counterattack with two divisions on June 24th that proved a failure. He found out what Grant already knew. 6 weeks of fighting had severely impaired the ability of both armies to attack the other. Both armies settled into a protracted engagement over miles of entrenchments. Union artillers brought up the huge guns in an attempt to disrupt operations in the Petersburg city center. In late July, a correspondent noted that the houses, even the woods and fields for miles around Petersburg, were filled with women and children and old men who had fled from their houses. The most famous of the artillery firing on Petersburg was the Dictator, shown here, a 13-inch mortar which shot 200-pound shells at a range of 2.5 miles. More deadly for soldiers was the smallest size mortar, known as a cohorn, that could be hand-carried up close to enemy trenches. That blue... That was the best cohorn picture I could get. You can see the little tube there where the blue, the arrow is. You carry that on four handles up near to the lines and lob with a trajectory over the lines. And if the shell bursts open, then you can rain shrapnel down on the people in the trench. It's a very, very effective weapon when used correctly and hated by the men. The next major incident in the siege was the Battle of the Crater. It is perhaps the best known of the series of battles that made up the siege and was made even more famous by providing the opening scene to the film version of the novel Cold Mountain. Those are two scenes from that early sequence in Cold Mountain. The story of that battle begins with an idea that came from a chance remark of a coal miner in the 48th Pennsylvania in late June. Lieutenant Colonel Henry Pleasance, the regiment's commander, overheard one of his men to say that the strong Confederate fort opposite their lines could be blown up if they could dig a mine underneath it. Pleasance, a mining engineer, was intrigued and figured out a means to make it happen. He convinced his superiors of the wisdom of the idea, and within days, digging was underway. The plan worked perfectly, and 3 weeks later, the mine was packed with four tons of powder and backfilled with a fuse running along the base. That's a diagram. You can see how the tunnel entrance there, which, by the way, you can visit in Petersburg, it's still there, is concealed from Confederate view. You also notice that it slopes up. What happened was that the miners ran into a bed of marl that turned almost to stone as soon as it was exposed to air. And so they actually went up a little bit and climbed that elevation, which put them closer to the Confederate fort and was probably made the resulting explosion stronger. It was a notable technological feat. Confederate soldiers, thinking they heard digging underneath, started to dig counter mines, but failed to break through and stopped altogether when the Union Army stopped digging because the mine was completed. Confederate engineers, calculating the distance, discounted the possibility of a mine because a shaft of such length could not be ventilated, a problem Pleasance had in fact solved. But again, a well-planned Union scheme came to naught in its execution. Pleasance's corps commander was Major General Ambrose Burnside, and he was a brave, amiable, and ambitious man given to taking chances on ingenious schemes such as the one his subordinate proposed. He was also an incompetent general, lazy, inattentive to detail, prone to confusion when plans went awry, and always, as he put it, trusting to luck. Burnside is a notable character in the Civil War, and not just because of his beard, which stood out in a particularly hairy era. So remarkable was his whiskers that an inversion of Burnside's name we now know as Sideburns. During the war, Burnside's career had taken several twists. After initial successes in capturing parts of the coast of North Carolina, Burnside rose to command the Army of the Potomac in November 1862. A month later, his army met with disaster at Lee's Hand at Fredericksburg, and sacked soon after, Burnside redeemed his reputation by capturing and successfully defending Knoxville, Tennessee in late 1863. Brought east again to serve with the Army of the Potomac, Burnside had not distinguished himself in corps command. So confident was he of success, however, that on July 30th, the day that the mine was to be detonated, Burnside's baggage was packed because he expected to spend the night in downtown Petersburg. Grant, after initially being skeptical of the idea, warmed to it and launched a diversion that successfully diverted Lee's attention and paved the way for a massive assault. Burnside planned to lead the attack with his freshest and largest division, and those troops began practicing the tactics needed to make the attack a success. After the explosion of the mine, the plan called for troops to move laterally along the trenches to widen the gap caused by the demolition of the targeted Confederate fort. Widening that gap would allow troops to rush directly towards Petersburg, splitting Lee's army in two and making the city untenable. Grant, however, at the last minute, accepted the recommendation of Army of the Potomac commander George G. Meade that the plan be changed. Burnside planned to attack with a division made up entirely of African American soldiers. Meade and Grant both feared that the political fallout if the attack failed, and that they would be accused of sacrificing the black soldiers on a risky maneuver that was bound to fail. Burnside, incredibly, had his three other division commanders draw lots to see who would make the first attack. It was the Army of the Potomac's great misfortune that had the short straw was drawn by Brigadier General James Ledlie. It would be impossible to imagine a worse choice. Ledley was inexperienced, over his head, a coward, and a drunk. Moreover, his division was among the most used up in the entire army. I don't know how well you can see. This is a contemporary sketch of the explosion mine. Sort of tree-looking thing up at the upper right. In the pre-dawn darkness of July 30th, the fuse to the mine was lit, and nearly 15,000 Union troops waited in anticipation of the explosion. When it detonated, it created a crater 60 feet wide and 30 feet deep. But the attack was slow in starting. The obstacles had not been cleared, and no ladders had been built to allow men to climb up out of the trenches. When the assault finally did get underway, it was ragged, poorly led, and coming up to the edge of the crater, the U.S. troops, instead of moving around it, went directly into the hole, seeking shelter from a gathering Confederate resistance. That resistance came together with laudable speed, and one has to thank Lee for that. By the July 1864, Lee had spent more than 2 years shaping his army. He had fostered a culture where initiative, especially aggressive initiative, was rewarded. Much of Lee's success can be traced to individual commanders, generals he had picked, who responded without orders to the sound of guns. One such commander was Virginia-born and VMI-educated Billy Mahone, one of the crack division commanders in Lee's army. Mahone was everywhere that morning, rallying troops, bringing up artillery, and sealing off avenues of advance. Confederates brought up the dreaded Coehorn mortars, which rained deadly shell on the U.S. soldiers who concentrated into the crater where they sought shelter. Burnside could think of no other alternative but to continue the attack by feeding more of his men into the fray. The reinforcements eventually included the black troops, an action that enraged the Confederates opposing them. By mid-morning, the order was given to withdraw, but the alternatives facing the remaining Federal troops were dire. They could run the gauntlet back towards their line, exposing themselves to enemy fire. They could try to surrender, a difficult thing to do in such close quarters. The African-American troops knew that they would be killed if taken prisoner, or if they were very lucky and somehow survived, would be enslaved. They fought with a ferocity matched by that of the Confederates. That's a picture of what the crater looked like after year worth of erosion in April 1865. In the end, 5,500 Union soldiers, about half of them African Americans, were lost. Confederates pegged their casualties at just over 1,000, and most of them were lost in the initial explosion. Grant wired Washington that it was the saddest affair I have witnessed in this war, adding, sadly, "Such an opportunity for carrying fortifications I have never seen and do not expect again to have." That's virtually the same view today. You can visit the crater and still see the traces of it. Burnside took a leave of absence, an absence that became permanent. He would never again command troops. Ledley, who spent most of the battle dead drunk in a bombproof behind the lines, took sick leave and was later all but read out of the army. That action, one of his officers said dryly, was a heavy loss to the enemy. One can get the impression that the rest of the Siege of Petersburg was a boring stalemate, and it is true that there was not another incident as dramatic as the Battle of the Crater. It is true that soldiers began to build elaborate trenches like these, but it was not a quiet period. As long as the roads were dry enough to support advances during the rest of the summer and into the fall of 1864, Grant attempted several times to gain a marginal advantage over Lee. Most of these took the form of attacking on the northern end of the line near Richmond or swinging ever wider to the south and west below Petersburg. The latter advances were consistently designed to threaten, if not cut off altogether, the roads and railroads that fed into Petersburg from points further south. Lee was able to successfully counter most of these advances by using his interior and shorter lines to rush troops to threaten points. Put another way, Grant was compelled to operate on the outside of the arc, and his soldiers traveled mostly by foot. Lee used his shorter lines on the interior of the arc and was able to make some use of the railroads to transfer troops from one threatened sector to another. However, like Grant, Lee's attacks were seldom successful in dislodging Grant from a prepared position, and the overall result was that Lee found his line slowly extended further and further. Moreover, it should be noted that however successful Lee's defense was in a tactical sense, Grant's overall strategic plan succeeded. Mobile Bay fell to naval forces in early August, and Sherman captured Atlanta on September 1. Both victories helped boost Lincoln's reelection prospects. Also helping the reelection effort were Phil Sheridan's September and October victories over Jubal Early in the Shenandoah Valley. Lincoln's reelection was a heavy blow to the Confederacy, but it also had a significant effect on the final stages of the Petersburg struggle. Freed from election coalition worries, Lincoln tacitly gave Grant more discretion in replacing subordinates, and gradually the underperformers who owed their rank to political connections were weeded out. In their places and in other appointments went professional soldiers who were already tried and trusted by Grant. The overall result was that Grant had at last an army that was much more responsive to his way of fighting. I had a bunch of extra slides in there. Hope you enjoyed the tour. The devastation in the Shenandoah, the breadbasket of the Confederacy, and the inexorable and slowly increasing Union pressure on the remaining roads and railroads that made Petersburg key to Richmond resulted in a long winter for Lee's army. The Confederate commander could face the facts. As early as October, he was heard to exclaim, "If we cannot get the men, all that is left of us is to make peace on the best terms we can." As the supply problems became acute, Lee warned Richmond in February 1865 that "my army is starving." The sacking of an incompetent commissary general resulted in almost immediate relief, and as the ground in the winter camps began to thaw, Lee wrote that he had not been so well supplied in many months. Supply was never a problem for the Union lines. The massive depot at City Point was connected by a railroad to the Federal camps and trenches. There was some impatience, albeit no little good humor. Meet Rufus Ingalls' dog. Ingalls had been Grant's roommate at West Point and served with Grant in California after the Mexican War. Rufus Ingalls knew the General Cheech better than just about anybody else in the Army when Grant arrived with the Army of the Potomac winter camps in March 1864. He was a superb quartermaster general, a position he had held since the Army of the Potomac was founded. Like most quartermasters through the ages, Ingalls liked his comforts. This is him in the spring of 1864. Notice that none of the uniforms show any mud, that the shoes are polished, that there are wood huts to sleep in, that there appears on the right-hand side to be actually an attached latrine. And it's a nice chair that Rufus Ingalls is sitting in there in the center with that ridiculous hat. That wasn't me. Here, for example, are Ingalls and Grant's quarters at City Point, with Grant's being on the right and Ingalls on the left. They were about 100 yards apart. You can see them now today. Ingalls was a regular at a campfire where Grant and his associates would gather after dinner, even in the raw winter months. Sometime in early 1865, at one of those gatherings, Grant, who had much more of a sense of humor than we readily give him credit for, teased Ignol about his sometimes bumptious dog. Would he be taking his dog with him to Richmond, Grant asked. Oh, yes, deadpanned Ignol's. He is a very long-lived breed. The truth, however, is Grant was close to breaking Lee's lines. Lee knew it, and Grant knew it. The two of them were more alike than is usually recognized, and by this point, both recognized what the other would do. Lee and Grant had in common a moral courage that was reflected in their predilection towards offensive warfare. Grant once characterized his approach to war this way. Find out where your enemy is, get at him as soon as you can, strike at him as hard as you can, and as often as you can, and keep moving on. While Lee probably would not have used his direct and pugnacious language, his preferred approach, like Grant, involves seizing the initiative, rapid advances, determined attacks, and screen maneuver. Knowing that Sherman, having completed his march to the sea, was now marching north through the Carolinas to link up with Grant, Lee decided to strike at Grant one last time in hopes of getting the Union commander to pull back from his advanced positions and perhaps contract his lines. Lee hoped then to be in a position to pull out of the Petersburg defenses and get away to join Joseph E. Johnston's scratched-together force trying to stop Sherman in North Carolina. Lee's desperate hope was that the combined force would defeat Sherman and then turn back to confront Grant. Lee summoned Lieutenant General John Gordon and asked him to plan the assault that would become known as the Battle of Fort Stedman. After carefully examining the Union lines, Gordon selected Fort Stedman, a small strong point some 150 yards from Confederate trenches, as his objective. The plan was to break the lines and hold them open so that Confederate cavalry could be let loose and cause havoc in the Federal rear lines. Lee gave Gordon command of some 10,000 men for the assault, a force similar in size to that which advanced at Gettysburg in what has become known as Pickett's Charge. The attack was made at 4 a.m. and was initially successful, but Gordon was unable to widen the breach beyond Fort Stedman. Union forces reacted quickly and counterattacked, and by mid-morning, the battle was over. Confederate losses were heavy, more than 3,500, while Union losses totaled just over 1,000 men. Known grandly as Lee's last great offensive, the Battle of Fort Stedman was a serious blow to Confederate hopes. Figuring correctly that Lee had weakened his defenses to provide manpower for the assault, Grant ordered a general advance. Several Confederate picket lines were seized, reducing the distance of any U.S. attack would take in the future. Grant also sent a combined cavalry and infantry force to the far western extreme of his lines in yet another attempt to break the one remaining railroad that fed Petersburg. This force, under the cavalry chief Philip Sheridan, smashed the Confederate defenses commanded by George Pickett of Gettysburg fame at a key intersection called Five Forks. That battle, fought on April the 1st, isolated Petersburg, making it untenable. But still, Lee's lines held. The end came the following day with a series of assaults. The most devastating was that launched by the Sixth Corps, led by Major General Horatio Wright. A cautious engineer, Wright had spent nearly a year as Corps commander and had learned to fight aggressively. His careful study of Confederate defenses convinced him that he could pierce the line at a point about 6 miles southwest of Petersburg. Using his entire corps aligned in an unconventional wedge-shaped attack formation, Wright successfully massed his men in no man's lines during the night of April 1st. At first light, Wright's men rolled over the Confederate line, tearing a huge and fatal hole in Lee's trenches at the cost of some 1,100 men. I understand you'll be visiting there at Pamplin Park, and you'll hear more about that breakthrough at that point. Rushing to rally his defeated soldiers, A.P. Hill was shot and killed by two Union stragglers. Lee was able, just barely, to stall the Union advance that afternoon, buying him time to make preparations to abandon both Petersburg and Richmond as he retreated across the Appomattox that night. The stillness of Appomattox lay but a week away. some final thoughts. First, the history of warfare can be viewed as a series of pendulum shifts where the advantage belongs first to the defense and then after some time, then to the offense. The Civil War in general and the siege in Petersburg in particular mark a turn from the advantage from the offensive to that of being on the defensive. The biggest factor in this shift, as usually is the case, is a marginal advance in technology. The rifled musket, in use universally by the end of the Civil War, increased the fatal firing range from 50 yards to nearly 400, a considerable force multiplier, to use a current term. Even when successful, rare was the attack in the Civil War that did not absorb more casualties than were inflicted on the enemy. This shift in advantage to the defense would persist until the inventions of tanks towards the end of World War I. Second, there is a myth that the war was lost because Lee, to quote the words of his farewell order to his men, issued after the surrender, had been, quote, compelled to yield to overwhelming numbers and resources. Lee was almost always outnumbered by a factor of 2-1, and yet had met success on many fields. While the odds certainly were long, there is nothing unusual in the numerical disparity Lee faced during the siege of Petersburg. Third, the person who made the difference, who figured out how to defeat Lee, was Ulysses S. Grant. As Gordon Ray, one of the most astute scholars of this, the last year of the war in Virginia, has observed, contrary to the image urged by Grant's detractors, the general's campaign against Lee revealed a warrior every bit as talented as the famous Confederate counterpart. Grant understood the importance of seizing the initiative and holding tight to the offensive edge to keep Lee off balance and to prevent him from going on the offensive. So to return to the image of Grant quietly planning the march to Petersburg, the army he took there was barely known to him, and he was in command mostly in a formal sense. 10 months later, as he led his men west to Appomattox, he was in full control. For a final word, we return again to his friend Rufus Ingalls. To the extent that Grant was remembered during his years as a West Point cadet, it was for his unfailing control of horses. And riding a particularly high-spirited horse, he had set a jumping record that stood there for decades. Grant recalled Ingalls had from childhood been known as particularly skilled at breaking horses. He succeeded in this, said Ingalls, not by punishing the animal he had taken in hand, but by patience and tact, and his skill in making the creature know what he wanted to have it do. And so it was with the Army of the Potomac. Thank you. Questions? Question was, when they were digging the mine to build the galleries where they packed 4 tons of powder, where did they put the dirt? Because, of course, you don't want to have the dirt be seen by the enemy because it would give away the fact that you were digging, right? Well, there was a gully behind, and to this day, supposedly, I've never seen it, but I've been told, you can still see the remains of what came out of the tunnel. They carried it and it was out of sight. I showed you a little bit of that diagram. The mine entrance was invisible to the Confederates. Had they built a tower, they might have been able to see it, perhaps. But it's maybe 20 feet lower than the Confederate fort and a distance of about 150 yards. And so they were able to conceal it and get it away. Well, I think there's certain similarities and certain problems. I mean, the fact was that by July 30th, there wasn't, as it was the case at Fort Stedman. Fort Stedman had a vast network of backup trenches that could be used for defensive positions. The Union troops, troops on both sides, had nothing to do but dig. And so they dug a lot, and the men were kept busy doing that. But in July 30th of 1864, there were not that many. And what's more, Fort Stedman was within about 500 yards of what is today Crater Road, which was a very major thoroughfare. Had the Union troops done what they were told to do, or what the plan was, which is to attack, not go into the crater, to attack immediately while the Confederates were disorganized, widen those gaps on the left and the right of the crater, and then men behind them going straight for what is now Crater Road, which was high ground, the result would have been considerably different. Yes, sir. Veteran troops whose enlistments were expiring. 65 regiments, 65 veteran regiments left the army between the beginning of the advance in May and the end of July. That's a huge loss in experienced men. And in terms of experienced commanders, I agree with you. The attrition of Lee was quite remarkable. I mean, he started out with Corps commanders. James Longstreet, who gets badly wounded at the Wilderness. A.P. Hill is sick almost the entire last year of his life. Jubal Early comes into his own. Gordon, as you mentioned, steps up, and some division commanders, such as Mahone, step up. But look on the Union side. Sedgwick gets killed at Spotsylvania. Warren's useless. Wright's initially quite inexperienced. I talked a bit about Burnside. Hancock has been is a shadow of his former self, and it goes that way on further down the line. So the command is on both sides. Here's the crucial difference. In the Civil War, the army that is attacking is going to suffer many more casualties, and many more things are going to go wrong in that attack. And it is relatively simple to defend a position and a prepared position, as Lee did throughout the Petersburg siege. And again, at no point did the odds against Lee get wildly out of whack in terms of roughly 2-1. He was always outnumbered, but he had been outnumbered all the time, all during the war, and it accomplished much with the men that he had.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Daniels.